Good morning, brothers and sisters. It's a great privilege to be here and to introduce Mr. Arun Gandhi to you. He was born in South Africa in 1934, and as you know, is the grandson of Mohandas K. Gandhi, better known as Mahatma Gandhi, translated as the Great Soul. Mr. Gandhi's grandfather was truly a remarkable man. At his funeral, it was said of him that he was the conscience of mankind, one who made humility and simple truth more powerful than empires. Albert Einstein proclaimed that future generations will scarce believe that one such as this walked the earth. For grandson Arun, growing up in apartheid in South Africa was a difficult, humiliating, and often a dangerous proposition, a target of bigoted attacks from blacks as well as white. Young Arun became increasingly angry and vowed that he would soon fight back and get even. Hoping that a stay with his grandfather would help Arun to control his angers, his parents sent him to live with the Mahatma for 2 years in 1946. This was a turbulent time in the history of India in their struggle for freedom, and young Arun got to view at close range the world-changing events as these unfolded right before his eyes, and he got to observe closely the effects of nonviolence and violence. He was also tutored by his grandfather daily. Between 5 and 6 each day, the grandfather would sit his grandson down and teach him the principles of nonviolence. When Arun left India after this experience, he left determined to devote his life to teaching principles of nonviolence. This determination was strengthened by his parents, Sushila and Manilal, who themselves devoted their lives to nonviolence. Manilal was in prison for 16 years of his life due to his efforts in this regard. They chose to raise their children according to principles of nonviolence, including what can be called loving discipline. When Mr. Gandhi was here last year, he told a powerful story to exemplify the teaching of his own parents. When young Arun had just gotten his driver's license, like many teenagers, he did some dumb things and then compounded them by lying to his father about them. Turned out the father knew that he was lying and had a most unusual reaction to that. He said, "I see that I failed to teach you the value of honesty, and to help me better understand how I can teach you honesty, I'm going to walk home." Well, home was 18 miles away. And by the time the young Arun had driven home very slowly behind his father for 18 miles, he had a determination that he would never lie again. And as I thought about this, it sounds like the hearers of King Benjamin's discourse, who had no more disposition to do evil, but to do good continually. At the age of 23, Arun moved back to India, worked as a reporter for the Times, and met and married his wife, Sunanda. He also formed the Center for Social Unity. The center's mission was and still is to alleviate poverty and caste discrimination by providing members of the untouchable class with self-help models of commerce. Mr. Gandhi will elaborate on this theme when he returns to campus on Friday to speak at the keynote session of the Microcredit Conference to be held at the Wilkinson Center on Friday and Saturday. Mr. Gandhi lived in India through most of his adult life and then came to the United States in the 80s to study racial relations and the civil rights movement in the United States. In 1991, he and his wife, Sunanda, formed the Gandhi Institute of Nonviolence, housed at Christian Brothers University in Memphis, Tennessee. The work of this center is to promote the works of nonviolence throughout the world. You will have a chance to see, as I have seen, that Mr. Gandhi is not only the son and the grandson of a great soul, but is truly a great soul himself. And it's my great pleasure now to present to you Mr. Arun Gandhi.
Thank you very much. It's a great honor to be here today to speak to you on this occasion. The 21st century is coming, and where are we going is a question that we need to ask ourselves as we sit on the threshold of the 21st century. The 20th century has become the most violent century in human history. We have killed more people in this century than we have killed in any of the past centuries. And by the indications, we continue to kill more and more people and destroy more and more human lives all over the world, which makes one wonder what is going to happen to us in the 21st century. I am reminded of a question that a Western correspondent asked grandfather in 1945 after the atom bomb was thrown on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. He said, "What is the future of humankind?" And grandfather's response was that up to now we had the option of choosing between violence or nonviolence. Now the only options left to us is nonviolence or non-existence. Now, although he said this in terms of the nuclear threat that he perceived at that moment, but he also said it in terms of the spiritual threat that affected all of us. It's not just the wars that we need to be concerned about, but our loss of humanity that is also a matter of great concern. We are becoming so immune to violence that we don't care what happens to people. And this kind of a spiritual death is more dangerous than all the violence that we can see around us. Now, I don't need to give you statistics to prove how violent we are, but I'm going to share with you a few of them just to give you an indication of what is happening to us. I recently came across these statistics relating to handgun deaths. And it was amazing to me, and I'm sure when you hear these statistics, you will also be as amazed as I was, at why is it that the most advanced country in the world, the most progressive country in the world, the most developed country in the world, is also the most violent country in the world? And it doesn't fit together, because one expects that as we progress, we are progressing towards civilization. As we develop, we are developing towards better human beings. And if that is the case, then why is it that we are becoming so violent? In 1992, a research was done on handgun-related deaths in some of the more advanced countries of the world. And the results were shocking. They found that in the year 1992, there were 13 handgun-related deaths in Australia, 33 in Britain, 36 in Sweden, 60 in Japan, 87 in Switzerland, 128 in Canada, and 13,220 in the United States. Now, we've got to find out why is this happening and what can we do to stop this from happening. We don't want to make the 21st century a more violent century than the 20th century. We want to reverse the course and make it less violent so that we can all live in peace and harmony with each other. And we can do this, we can achieve this, if we are determined to make that effort. But if we continue to flow with the tide and say that we can't do anything about it and whatever we do is not going to make much of an impact on anybody anyway, then we are just going to face the situation that we come across and live with it and perish with it. But each person can make that difference. And this has been shown to us in the way grandfather got up and made a difference when he was faced with humility. Now, he didn't intend to become a great person. In fact, when he came back from England with a degree in law, his only intention was to set up a legal practice and earn money so that he could pay back the loans that the family had taken for his education. He was desperately trying to set up this legal practice in India, and for some reason he failed miserably. For 2 years he couldn't set up a practice, and then he got this opportunity to go to South Africa to represent an Indian merchant who had a legal problem with another Indian merchant, and both of them had hired white British lawyers, and neither of them could speak English. And so the lawyers were having a good time taking their clients for a ride. The cases were going on endlessly, and they were being drained of all their funds. And one of them got the bright idea of getting grandfather there and asking him to interpret between him and his lawyer. So he was taken there as an interpreter, not even as a lawyer. And he was so desperate that he grabbed that opportunity and went there. And ironically today, if it hadn't been for racism and prejudice, we may not have had a Gandhi. I wouldn't be here standing and talking to you about my grandfather. He may have been just another successful lawyer who had made a lot of money. But because of prejudices in South Africa, he was subjected to humiliation within a week of his arrival in that country. And it was that experience of being thrown off a train because of the color of his skin that humiliated him so much that he sat on the platform of the station all night wondering what could he do to gain justice. His first response was one of anger. He was so angry by the humiliation that he wanted eye for an eye justice. He wanted to respond violently to the people who humiliated him. And he stopped himself because he said, that's not right. It's not going to get him justice. It might make him feel good for the moment that he was able to humiliate the person who humiliated him. But that wasn't going to get him any justice. The second response was to go back to India and live among his own people in dignity. And he ruled that out also because he said, you can't run away from problems, you've got to stay there and face the problems. And that's when the third response dawned on him, the response of nonviolent action. And from that point onwards, he developed the philosophy of nonviolence and practiced it in his life as well as in his search for justice in South Africa, and ended up staying in that country for 22 years, and then went and led the movement in India. Now, had it not been for that one moment when he was humiliated, he wouldn't have made that change in his life. So each one of us do face these moments in our lives, but we don't make the right choices. We submit to anger, and in our search for eye for an eye justice, we increase the level of violence that we see in our societies. Now, we can make that right choice if we learn how to deal with anger positively. Now, this is an aspect of grandfather's philosophy that not many people have focused on. People have focused on the philosophy, the part of his philosophy that deals with reacting to an injustice. And we think that that is the whole philosophy, that whenever you see an injustice taking place somewhere, you react to that situation in the best way you can, as peacefully as you can. But there is the proactive part of his philosophy that not many people have focused on, and that is, how do we avoid conflicts? It's one thing to learn how to resolve conflicts peacefully, but it's quite another to learn how to avoid conflicts altogether. And if we look at ourselves and examine our lives, we will find that many of the conflicts in our lives emerge from two main sources. One is our inability to deal with anger positively, and the other is our inability to build good relationships, meaningful relationships. And if we can learn these two things, we would be able to reduce violence in human society by as much as 85 to 90%. But it's very important that we learn to do these things. And we're so ashamed of anger that we don't even want to talk about it, let alone teach it. We just tell people that it's bad to keep anger pent up inside. You've got to get it out of your system, find your own way of doing it, punch a pillow or go out into the woods and yell at the trees. But get it out of the system. And that's the important thing. But that is not important. Getting it out of the system may help you momentarily to bring peace to you. But if you don't address yourself to that problem, it's going to come back again and again, and you're going to be faced with this situation until you give up and just respond in anger. So it's essential that we learn how to deal with that positively. Now, Grandfather taught me this very powerful lesson when I came to India as a 12-year-old boy. As you were told in the introduction, I lived in South Africa and suffered the same kind of humiliation that Grandfather suffered. But at a very young age, I was 10 years old when I was beaten up by some white youths one day in the streets. When I was minding my own business, these three young men wanted some pleasure and they just picked on me and beat me up. And then a few months later, I was beaten up by some black youths for the same reason. For the whites, I was too black, and for the blacks, I was too white. And I was filled with that anger and rage, and I wanted eye for an eye justice, because that's what I knew. And it became such an obsession with me that I subscribed to Charles Atlas's exercise programs to pump iron so that I could deal with all these people. And that's when my parents decided it was time to take me to India and give me the opportunity to learn something from Grandfather. And I'm very grateful to my parents for having taken that decision, because I think in many ways the 18 months that I spent with Grandfather laid the foundations of my understanding of his philosophy. And one of the first lessons that he taught me was learning how to deal with that anger. He told me that anger is like electricity. It's just as powerful and just as useful as electricity is, but only if we use it intelligently and with respect. But if we abuse electricity, we can destroy ourselves and destroy everything around us. And so just as we channel electricity and bring it into our lives and use it for all the good that we use electricity for, we must be able to channel anger in the same way and use it for the good of humanity. He suggested that I should write an anger journal, but write the journal with the intention of finding a solution, not with the intention of keeping that anger alive. A lot of people have told me over the years that they've been writing anger journals and it hasn't really helped them, because every time they go back and read the journal, they just feel a renewal of the anger. It all keeps coming back to them. And I told them, I said, you try writing it with the intention of finding a solution, and then commit yourself to finding a solution. And that's very important. If we commit ourselves to finding a solution, then we'll be able to find that solution and put that whole episode behind us. And I did that for many years, and I've been able to channel my anger very substantially into constructive ways of dealing with situations. And I think in many ways, the reason why I'm here and I'm doing the type of work that I am doing is because I've been able to channel that anger to help people understand and improve their own lives in the process there. Now, I was a feisty young boy at that time, and I wanted to see whether grandfather had learned the lesson that he was trying to teach me. And I decided to test him and see whether he had learned it well. This was the time when he was in the midst of all these high-level political discussions. Britain had already decided to give India independence. Negotiations were going on how to transfer power to Indian leaders. India was also going to be divided into India for Hindus and Pakistan for the Muslims. And that was something that concerned grandfather very much because he didn't want the country to be divided. And all of these important things were happening there. And along with that, all through his struggle for independence, he was also concerned about the emancipation of women, about the emancipation of the so-called untouchable people in India, and also the education of children. So he had all of these programs going on simultaneously. And to raise funds for all these programs, he decided that the easiest way for him to do so would be to sell his autographs. And so he put a fee of $5 for each autograph. And every morning and evening after his prayer services, when people would gather for his autograph, it was my duty to go out into the audience and pick up their autograph books and the money and bring it to him for his signature. And one day I thought, I said, if everybody could get his autograph, why not me? And so I got myself an autograph book and I slipped it into the pile and hoped that he wouldn't notice the absence of money there. But he was very shrewd. When he came to my autograph book, he said, why is there no money for this autograph? I said, because it's my book. And he said, well, you should know that I don't make an exception even for grandsons. That if you want an autograph, you will not only have to pay me for it, but you'll have to earn the money and pay me. And I said, no way. I said, you are my grandfather and I'm going to make you give me this autograph free. And he laughed and said, all right, let's see who wins. And from that day, every day when he was in the midst of these high-level political discussions with British politicians and Indian politicians, I would barge into the room with my autograph book and thrust it in his face and demand an autograph. My logic was that just to get rid of me, he'll sign the book and give it to me. But instead, every time I became too boisterous, all he did was put his hands across my mouth, pressed my head against his chest, and went on talking politics. On many occasions, some of the other politicians used to get exasperated and tell grandfather, why don't you give him the autograph and be done with it? He comes and disturbs our meetings every day. And grandfather would only laugh and say, no, this is our private joke. You don't have to get involved in it. But the long and short of it is that he never did give me that autograph. But I don't remember his ever telling me to get out of the room and leave him alone, like we do with our children. When they come into the room while we are working on something important, we shoo them away and say, get out, leave me alone, we'll talk about it later, all that kind of thing. But he never ever did that. And that's when I realized that he had really very substantially taken control of his anger and was able to make a difference. I had an occasion to put this to test in another way much later in 1968 when I was living in India, a victim of apartheid because the South African government wouldn't allow me to bring my wife, Indian-born wife, to South Africa. I was forced to live in India. Not that I regretted it, but it was, in a way, victimization. And in 1968, a friend of mine from South Africa was coming to India for the first time. He was very nervous about making this trip, so he wrote to me to come and receive him at the docks when the ship arrived and to make arrangements for his stay in India and his travels and all that. And so when I went to the docks, his ship arrived at 10 o'clock in the night, and I was the first Indian to go on board. And instead of meeting my friend, I met a strange white man who came up to me and grabbed hold of my hand and shook it profusely and introduced himself as Mr. Jackie Basson, Member of Parliament from South Africa. And as the moment he told me his name, I recognized who he was. He was an extremely racist person. He was responsible for my humiliation. He was responsible in many ways for the apartheid policy because he supported his party's policy. And to me, he was the person responsible for what I felt and all the humility, humiliation that I felt then. And so my first response was to tell him to go and jump in the sea. I was, you know, in that flash, all the experiences in South Africa just flashed through my mind. And that anger came up and I wanted to tell him and humiliate him and tell him, go and jump into the sea, I'm not going to do anything for you. But I stopped myself immediately and said, what will grandfather say if I did that? And I knew that not only he would not forgive me, but even my parents would not forgive me if I did that. And so I changed. And I shook hands with him and I said, I'm glad to meet you. I am also a victim of apartheid, having to live in this country because your government won't allow me to bring my Indian-born wife there. But I'm not going to hold that against you. You are a guest, and I'm going to try and make your stay here as pleasant as possible. And they were in Bombay for about 5 days. And every day, from early in the morning to late in the night, we would be together. We would do everything from eating breakfast to going around doing all the touristy things and shopping and all of that. And during the time, I would try to question him and ask, try to find out how he could justify apartheid. And he would make a valiant attempt to justify it to me. And every time the discussion became a little uneasy, we would stop and change the topic and talk about the weather. And I was surprised on the fifth day when my wife and I went and said final farewells to them. Both of them embraced us and literally wept tears of remorse. I mean, they were genuinely crying. And they asked us for forgiveness. They said, in this short time, you have opened our eyes and you made us understand how evil apartheid and prejudice is. And we are making a promise to you that we are going to go back to South Africa and fight apartheid. I was still a skeptic at that time, and I wasn't willing to accept this on the face of it. So I told my wife quietly, I said, let's wait and see. You know, these people have a habit of coming out and saying one thing and going back and doing something else altogether. So let's wait and see whether he really meant it or he was just saying it to make us feel nice. And we followed his political career for the next 7-8 years. And we realized that he had changed. He had changed to such an extent that he was eventually thrown out of his party. He lost his elections. But he remained firm in his conviction that apartheid was evil. Now that was the change that we were able to bring about in confirmed racist. In just 5 days of simple dialogue, a friendly discussion could bring about that kind of change in the people. And that's when I realized the power of nonviolence, that it is very effective if we learn how to use it properly. But we do a lot of passive violence against people. You know, we are so focused on the physical violence that we don't look at the passive violence. And this, again, was a very important lesson that I learned from Grandfather. When he taught me to make a family tree of violence, in the same way as we build a genealogical tree, he said every day before you go to bed, put down on that tree all the experiences of violence that you've had during the day, things that you may have read or seen or observed or even perpetrated against other people. You have to be honest and put all of that down on that tree. Violence, he said, is the grandparent, with physical violence and passive violence as the two offsprings. Now, physical violence is something that we know and understand because it hurts. It's all the physical manifestations of violence, the wars, the killings, the beatings, the rapes, murders, all of these things where we use physical force against one another. But passive violence is the type of violence that we do to one another consciously or unconsciously, where we don't use any physical force, but our body language, our attitudes, the way we speak to people, the way we look at people, the things that we do to people and say to people, all of these things are acts of violence also. And actually, it is that passive violence that we commit all the time, knowingly or unknowingly, that generates anger in the victim, and that anger then translates into physical violence. So in effect, it is this passive violence that fuels the fire of physical violence. So if we want to put out the fire of physical violence, logically we have to cut off the fuel supply. And the fuel supply is us, each one of us. So we have to look at our own selves and acknowledge that we are violent and that we need to change. And that exercise that Grandfather made me do was a way of acknowledging my own violence, learning about my own violence and acknowledging it. I'm sure if I ask all of you now whether you are violent or nonviolent, you will all be willing to swear on the Bible that you are nonviolent. But, you know, we are all partly true. We are nonviolent only in the sense that we don't go out and beat up people or kill people. But we are violent in the sense that we practice a lot of passive violence. And unless we acknowledge that and change that, we'll never be able to create a peaceful society. It's a very important lesson for us to learn. I learned another very important lesson from him over a little pencil. A little 3-inch stub of a pencil became the object of a major lesson for me. When I was coming back from my tuitions one day, and I was 13 years old then, and walking home, and you know how careless 13 years old are, I had this pencil in my hand and a notebook, and I looked at that pencil and I said, I deserve a better pencil. This is too small for me to use. And so I threw it away. And that evening when I met Grandfather, I asked him for a new pencil. And instead of giving me a new pencil, he subjected me to a lot of questions. He wanted to know how the pencil became small and why did it become small and where did I throw it away and on and on and on. And I couldn't understand why he was making such a fuss over a little pencil until he told me to go out and look for it. And I said, you must be kidding. He said, you don't expect me to look for this little pencil in the dark? He said, oh yes, I do. Here's a flashlight. This will help you. And he sent me out with a flashlight to look for this pencil, and I think I searched the bushes for about 3 hours. And when I finally found the pencil and brought it to him, he said, now I want you to sit here and learn two very important lessons. The first lesson is that even in the making of a simple thing like a pencil, we use a lot of the world's natural resources. And when we throw them away, we are throwing away the world's natural resources, and that is violence against nature. The second lesson is that because in an affluent society we can afford to buy all of these things in bulk, we overconsume these things. And because we overconsume the resources of the world, we are denying those resources to people elsewhere who have to live in poverty, and that is violence against humanity. And that was the first time I realized how wide and broad his philosophy of nonviolence was. That every little thing that we did every day, throwing away things or wasting things or destroying things, were acts of violence. And we do this all the time. I mean, I've been living on university campuses for 12 years in the United States, and I've never had to buy a pen or a pencil because I find them lying all over the campus. And I'm constantly picking up these pens and pencils and using them, and many of the students who've seen me doing this, they think I'm a crank, and they come running to me and say, Mr. Gandhi, here's a pencil we found for you. And I hope that someday they will learn the profound lesson that I learned from you. But I have to come to an end now, and I want to share two last stories to show you how we can build relationships between people, and which is a very important thing. We have to live what we want our children to learn. Now, there was a little boy, 6 years old, who was living in the community that Grandfather had created, a community in which I was living with him when we were visiting India. And this boy and I were very good friends. And he had a very strong sweet tooth. He just couldn't resist sweets. He would eat excessive amounts of sweets. And so the result was that he started getting all these boils on his body all over. And his parents took him to the doctor. And the doctor said, you've got to stop him from eating sweets. No more sweets until he's cured of this ailment. And so the parents came home and they would nag the boy every day and tell him that you are not going to get sweets anymore. The doctor has said no sweets for you. And yet there were sweets on the table and everybody else was eating the sweets. The result was that this boy didn't obey his parents. When nobody was looking, he would grab some of the sweets and eat it. And the result also was that he couldn't be cured. And so after a few days, the mother came with him to Grandfather and said, will you please explain to this boy that he is not to eat sweets. He won't listen to us. We have been trying to tell him this for several days, but he won't listen to us. Now I want you to speak to him. And Grandfather said, all right, you come back after 15 days and I'll speak to him. And so the mother went back and She came back after 15 days, and grandfather took this boy aside, spoke to him for less than half a minute, and the boy went home and gave up sweets, wouldn't touch sweets anymore. And the mother was puzzled. She came back to grandfather and asked him, "What kind of miracle did you perform that we were telling him to do the same thing and he wouldn't listen to us, and yet you just spoke to him for a half minute and he has obeyed you?" And grandfather said, "It wasn't a miracle. The only thing I told him was that I've given up eating sweets for 15 days and I'm not going to eat sweets until you are allowed to eat sweets. And I hope that you will give it up too." Now the parents were not doing this. They were using their parental authority to tell that child not to do something that the doctor said not to do. And so the child didn't obey that. We have to set an example through our own lives. The last story that I want to share with you is already partly told by Don. It happened to me when I was 16 years old, and we were back in South Africa and living on the Phoenix Ashram that grandfather had created, which was 18 miles outside the city of Durban. And it was in the midst of sugarcane plantations. Our nearest neighbors were 2 miles away from us. And any time my two sisters and I got an opportunity to go to town and visit friends or see a movie or something, we would grab the opportunity and go. And one Saturday, my father had to go to town to attend a conference, and he didn't feel like driving that day. And so he asked me if I would drive him into town and bring him back in the evening, and I jumped at the opportunity and said, "Yes, I will." And since I was going into town, my mom gave me a list of groceries that she needed. And on the way into town, my dad told me that there were many small chores that had been pending for a long time, like getting the car serviced and oil changed and all of that. He said, "You have the whole day to yourself. Please do these chores." And I said, "Okay." And when I left him at the conference venue, he said, "At 5 o'clock in the evening, I will wait for you outside this auditorium. Come here and pick me up and we'll go home together." And I said, "Fine." And I rushed off and I did all my chores as quickly as possible, bought the groceries, left the car in the garage with instructions to do whatever was necessary. And I went straight to the nearest movie theater. In those days, being a 16-year-old, I was extremely interested in Western movies, cowboy movies. John Wayne used to be my favorite actor. And I got so engrossed in a John Wayne double feature that I didn't realize the passage of time. The movie ended at 5:30, and I came out and ran to the garage and rushed to where Dad was waiting for me. It was almost 6 when I reached there. And he was anxious and pacing up and down, wondering what happened to me. And so the first question he asked me is, "Why are you late?" And instead of telling him the truth, I lied to him. And I said, the car wasn't ready. I had to wait for the car, not realizing that he had already called the garage and asked them. When he caught me in the lie, he said, "There's something wrong in the way I brought you up that didn't give you the confidence to tell me the truth, that you felt you had to lie to me. And I've got to find out where I went wrong with you. And in order to do that," he said, "I'm going to walk home 18 miles. I'm not coming with you in the car." There was absolutely nothing I could do to make him change his mind. It was after 6 o'clock in the evening, he started walking. Much of those 18 miles were through sugarcane plantations, dirt roads, no lights, late in the night. And I couldn't leave him and go away. So for 5.5 hours, I was crawling behind Father, watching him go through all this pain and agony for a stupid lie. And I decided there and then that I was never going to lie again. And I think of that episode very often. It's almost 50 years since the event, and every time I talk about it or think about it, I still get goosebumps. Now, that is the power of nonviolent action. It's a lasting thing. It's a change that we bring through love, not a change that we bring through fear. Anything that is brought by fear doesn't last. But anything that is done by love lasts forever. And I'd like you to remember this. Because as we come into the 21st century, you are the future leaders of the world. My generation has made a mess of this world, but your generation doesn't have to live with it. You can make a difference, and I hope you will make that difference, make the right choices, and make the difference so that the 21st century can be a more peaceful century than the 20th one. Thank you very much.